Okay, well, good morning, everyone. Thanks for attending. Today we're going to have what I think is a little bit of a different talk compared to what we've had at previous CNodes workshops. And anyone is having trouble hearing me at the back, just raise your hand and let me know. Okay, so the title of today's workshop is Mining the P's and Q's of Inference, Subtleties of Bayes' Theorem, P-Values, and Hypothesis Tests. And I hope that everyone in this room comes away with maybe a few things to think about at the end of today's workshop. Just quickly, I'd like to acknowledge the CNodes team, the CNodes investigators, as you see there, Sammy Suisa and David Henry, leading our network. I'm the site lead from British Columbia, Brenda Hemmelgarn from Alberta, who I know is here today as well. Gary Tier, I haven't seen Gary here yet. Is Gary in the room? No. Jacques Delaurier from Quebec, Adrian Levy, Pierre Ernst, CPRD, Ingrid Sketris, head of our KT team, and Robert Platt, head of our methods team, and from Manitoba, sorry, Dan, I didn't have your name in there. There should be Dan Chateau in there, Pat Martins, and Patricia Catano. I did put it in there for the DSECT workshop. I did update the slide. Okay, so today's objectives, there's five of them. We're going to describe Bayes' theorem and its relation to inference. We're going to discuss how p-values, confidence intervals, and hypothesis tests are used or misused is probably a better word for it. We're going to actually work through a reasonably simple Bayesian analysis of a CNode study that we've already done. And then we're going to discuss alternative definitions for probability, which is important because there is more than one definition out there. And sometimes maybe we don't think about what we mean by probability when we're thinking of a probability. And then number five is something I'm really excited about. We're going to talk about likelihood ratios as a possible common ground between Bayesian methods and the frequentist methods that we tend to use. But I think first we should start with some definitions, just so that we're clear on a few things. Let's start with a few basic definitions. Let's start with the definition of data. Data is factual information, such as measurements, which are used as a basis for reasoning or discussion. So data is used as a basis for reasoning or discussion. Inference is the derivation of conclusions from given information or premises by an acceptable form of reasoning. And evidence is that which tends to prove or disprove something. It's a grounds for belief or proof. But what I wanted to get across to everyone by putting these definitions on the slide, which seems somewhat simple, is that I think there's a belief, for lack of a better word, out there that data and evidence are synonyms. And that's not true. Data are a basis for reasoning. The data don't speak for themselves. We need to put something on the data, which is a reasoning process. And that's the point I really wanted to get across, because it's important when we talk about Bayes' theorem. There are two types of inference. There's deductive inference and inductive inference. On the left is an example of deductive inference. I'm not a physician, but if you gave me the name of a disease, I could go dust off some of my university textbooks and I could come back to you and I could list to you the common signs and symptoms of that disease. That's deductive inference, and if you have the textbook, it's pretty easy deductive inference. The real kind of inference we're interested in, though, is inductive inference, working the other way, working from the observed world, which are the signs and symptoms, to the underlying truth, what the disease is that we're diagnosing or a physician is diagnosing. This is the real skill that physicians have. They have the ability through their training and experience to take signs and symptoms, which could represent numerous different diseases, and hopefully come to the right disease. But finding the truth of the underlying world based on what we observed, so that is an exercise in inductive inference. And it was solved mathematically a couple hundred years ago by the Reverend Thomas Bayes. And it's quite a simple expression, and it's based on accepted rules of probability, the addition rule and the multiplication rule of probability. And you see those formulas up there. And that space theorem there, it's a, if the probability of A and B equals the probability of B and A, you can work through those conditional probabilities, and because they're equivalent, you can rearrange the terms and get Bayes' theorem. And what Bayes' theorem says in words is that if theta is your hypothesis and small y is some data set you have, it's saying that the probability your hypothesis is true given the data you've observed is equal to the probability of your data given the hypothesis times the probability of the hypothesis divided by a normalizing factor. And that's Bayes' theorem. And it's not... Bayesian analysis, I think, has some controversy associated with it, but Bayes' theorem itself is not controversial. It's widely accepted as being a correct mathematical theorem. And in fact, it's widely used in medicine already for screening tests. And Las Vegas would still be a desert without Bayes' theorem, because the casinos need to know how to set the games in order that they pay the house more than they pay the gambler. So let's work through an example, and there's a we're going to work through a couple of simple examples with Bayes' theorem to sort of understand some of the important aspects of the theorem. So imagine giving a PSA test to patients. And we'll assume that the PSA test is 71% sensitive and 91% specific. And that we're going to give that test to 1,000 men who are 35 years old. And where we have epidemiologic data suggesting that 0.6% of 35-year-old men have prostate cancer. Well, given the sensitivity and specificity of the test, which we think we know, and the net fraction of the population that has prostate cancer of that age, which we think we know, we can feed those numbers into a 2x2 table. And we said that 0.6% of 35-year-olds have prostate cancer, so we would expect 6 out of 1,000. Okay. Have prostate cancer, the remainder to not have prostate cancer. And we know based on the test characteristics that we should have 94% testing positive, 906 testing negative, and because of the sensitivity and specificity, we would know that four of those true prostate cancer cases will test positive, two will test negative, okay? And there's our sensitivity. And we know that because 91% specific, we also know the rest of these numbers. And we can feed them into Bayes' theorem. So we know from our epidemiologic data that 0.6% of 35-year-olds have prostate cancer. So we put that in over there. We know from our test characteristics the probability of testing positive given that you have prostate cancer. And we can just feed this into the formula. And what happens is that when you go from a population where before you tested these 1,000 men, you expected 0.6% of them to have prostate cancer, well, upon getting a positive test in any one of those men, the probability that a man who tests positive in this group, it only goes up to 4.5%. Okay? Before you tested a man, it was 0.6% chance coming in the door that he had prostate cancer. Upon testing positive, you're now only 4.5% confident that that 35-year-old has prostate cancer. Now, if we redo this test in 70-year-old men, 1,000 70-year-old men, where 36% of men at that age are expected to have prostate cancer, Same test characteristics, same sensitivity specificity. But now, upon a positive test, instead of going from 0.6% up to 4.5, we go from 36% up to 81.6% probability that a man who tests positive has prostate cancer. And so what this tells us about the importance of Bayes' theorem is the prior probability is really important. What the expectation is before looking at the data, if you feed it through the Bayes' theorem, really has implications for what you believe about the combined result after seeing the data. It's interesting, and we can even try a thought exercise of applying this to Bayes' theorem to drug approvals. And I got these data just on the internet. You can see the source down there. And we've all heard similar kind of numbers that it's really hard to discover drugs. You got to go through 5,000, 10,000 compounds and lots of armies of people making chemicals in laboratories. And of those 5 to 10,000, there's 250 that make it into preclinical testing. And then of those five go on to clinical trials. And then of those five, you have one that gets regulatory approval. Well, you can look at this slide and you can already start thinking of, well, what kind of priors would you have if you were about to evaluate a chemical for efficacy? What kind of priors might you develop going into your look at the data? I hope I'm correct about this. I think you can now get a drug approved on one phase three trial, right? Okay, so let's go through. This is still a thought exercise, so don't panic that there's at the actual numbers. It's a thought exercise, but I'm trying to use some plausible data. So if three compounds must be tested in a phase three trial for one to get a notice of drug approval, and if we therefore assume one in three of those are efficacious, and if we assume 27 new compounds are approved annually, and I just got that as average numbers for the last 30 years from the FDA, then how many false positive test results would occur if we assume normal type 1 and type 2 errors? Well, we can form another 2x2 table, and we can work through Bayes' theorem. Instead of having sensitivity and specificity, we're using alpha and beta for our false and positive, our error rates. And when we do that, we see that we get 27 drugs approved, which is what we expect, but based on our type 1, type 2 error rates, and knowing that some of those probably aren't efficacious that go into it, three of the drugs that test negative are actually efficacious drugs, and three of the drugs that test positive after their phase 3 trial would be not efficacious, and might go on to get a notice of drug approval. So that's kind of just another interesting use of Bayes' theorem. But again, so Bayes' theorem, not controversial as a theorem, and the prior probability that you bring in to your for your data analysis, this is a separate data analysis or a separate belief, that's very important. It has important implications for the amount of weight you place on your result after the analysis. Seems to be stuck. Only got three buttons, Adrian.
Which one is priority?
Thank you. Okay, so false positives and false negatives are known consequences of rejecting or accepting hypotheses based on error rates. The problem is that we use these, and I'll say we collectively, and I'm going to be wrong about some of you, but as a group of professionals, we use these frequentist properties, the idea that we're actually doing our study a very large number of times, to infer evidence on single studies when we tend to do single studies. And I'm just going to now sort of take you through the history of how that came to be, or at least how I perceive that came to be based on things I've read and encountered over time. This is happening again, so I don't know what's going on. Maybe, Dana, maybe you could just stand up there in case. Okay, so when I had in the title Mining the P's and the Q's, the P's are the p-values. So let's talk a little bit about p-values. The p-value is the probability of obtaining a result that is equal to the result you observed or a result more extreme than what you observed when it is assumed a null hypothesis is true. Ronald Fisher, famous statistician, most of you will have heard of him, he proposed a p-value method that could be used informally, and the key word is informally, to compare data from an experiment to the null hypothesis. Fisher never intended that the p-value be used as a formal method of inference. So how do we get a p-value? Well, we have some data, we often assume that the data behave according to some statistical distribution, like a normal distribution. We can calculate test statistics, and then from that test statistic, we can compare them to a table of values and obtain a p-value, which, as I said, is the probability of obtaining, in this case, that test statistic, or one more extreme than the one you've observed, given that the null hypothesis is true. And I'm stressing this twice because we'll see in a second. But first, here's what Ronald Fisher had said, and this is on the topic of why Fisher used it as an informal method. And I think this might be, I'm not sure, but I think this might be where 5% comes into our lexicon as the type 1 error rate we end up using. But he said, personally, the writer prefers to set a low standard, and he's referring to himself here, of significance at the 5% point. A scientific fact should be regarded as experimentally established if a properly designed experiment rarely fails to give this level of experiment. So if you try to interpret this, what he's saying is that a p-value, a small p-value, is not evidence. It means repeat the experiment. And if you get it again, repeat it again. Keep repeating the experiment. And then maybe if you've done this experiment many times, then you'll think, well, maybe we've got something here that's worth taking note of and changing the way we do things because of this result. But he was very clear this was not to be used in any single study. However, and I used to have a reference for this quote, but I've since reread the reference and I've decided to pull the quote back. But so maybe just take this first bullet as opinion, but we'll say too many researchers think a p-value of 0.05 means that the null hypothesis has only a 5% chance of being true. Okay? I don't think I have to convince you that a lot of people think that way about a p-value of 0.05. It might be something that we all just feel if I can't even provide a reference for it. But actually, the p-value is calculated under the assumption that the null is true. So if you're assuming something's true, you, as a basis for a number you're calculating, you can't correctly take that number as evidence that the null is false. You've assumed the null is true to calculate the number. If it's small, you then can't logically say, well, I'm assuming this is true, but now that it's small, you're wrong. It's a what do you call that, a circular kind of reasoning, right? So a little bit of a quiz for you. And just put up your hand if anyone wants to answer. A non-significant difference, where a p-value is 0.05, means there's no difference between treatment groups. How many agree with that? Good. Might just mean you have a small sample size, right? Doesn't mean that there's no difference. Studies conflict with each other when they produce p-values on opposite sides of 0.05. So say someone does the same, basically the same study and gets a p-value under 0.05, and someone does another study very similar and gets a p-value that's not significant. Does that mean, and what if their point estimates were the same? Does that mean that they're different? What if their point estimates are different? Does the p-values mean that one's more credible and one's not? There are many things that determine the p-value. Sample size is one of them. And so that's not true either. A p-value of 0.01 means that data were observed that would occur only 1% of the time under the null hypothesis. Is that true? Anyone? No, that's not true. Yeah, there's more. You could have more extreme results. That's right. So the p-value is giving credit for data that aren't even observed, right, in the case of any one study. How about this? Okay, a p-value equal to 0.05 and a p-value less than or equal to 0.05 mean the same thing. Anybody? Where do you think that comes from? Any guesses? So I have a p-value. We had a data analysis and we calculated a p-value. So we can calculate the number. Why would we ever write less than or equal to? This is confusing p with alpha. Alpha is what you set before your study. It's your type 1 error rate, which you should specify before you do your analysis, and p is what you calculate afterwards. This is the alpha and the p being confused as the same thing. P-values are properly written as inequalities. Anybody? Agree, disagree? again, this just shows how muddled the p-value thinking has become over time. If you can calculate the p-value, then you should calculate it. I would say, and maybe I think most of you would agree, that if the p-value is really small, up to a number of decimal places, then you can put that sign in there just to save not having to write out the whole number. And studies with the same p-value provide the same strength of evidence. How about that one? You could have a very, very large study that produced a rate ratio of 1.05, confidence interval 1.01 to 1.07. And you could have a very small study that had a similar p-value but a much larger effect. So the p-value doesn't, because it's dependent on these other things, unobserved data and sample size, it doesn't, equivalent p-values don't equate to the same strength of evidence in an analysis. There's something called the p-value fallacy, and this is just a bit of a thought exercise. But there's those points we went through on the last slide. What I was hoping to get through to you is some of the common misconceptions, and what's leading to these misconceptions is that researchers treat the p-value as having this dual role, where it's evidence for one study, and it's an error rate for long-term properties of doing many studies. And the reality is, the p-value can't serve this dual role. Okay, we can't claim it's something to guard us against making too many mistakes in the long run, and then say, but in this study, it means we've got evidence. And I've just got a little bit of another thought experiment for you here. So imagine just a very simple setup where we're going to recruit 40 patients into a trial. And we're going to just say that we're able to measure somehow whether the drug succeeded or failed. So 0 if it failed, 1 if it succeeded. And we'll assume that we're equivocal. Our expectation is that we're equivocal whether the drug succeeds or fails. And so when we do that, we can think of two examples. So maybe trial A happens where we start recruiting patients and we have successes and failures. And then, but at the end of all 40 patients being recruited and given the drug and seeing whether the drug's successful or not, at the end we have a p-value of 0.52. And so nothing to write home about here. And trial B, say we have the same result at the end, but depending on the sequence in which these successes and failures come in, you can have different p-values along the way. This is at the heart of why stopping clinical trials early is controversial. It's controversial because any short-run result can be part of a multitude of many long-run results. Okay, and this is the the swamp you get into when you use a p-value as evidence. Right? You're saying that this is evidence that this study, in this study. So the world is full of rare events for null hypotheses that are true. But what evokes our interest in these things is coming up with hypotheses that make the data more plausible. So if I were to shuffle a card of decks and deal you two of them and you got two aces, if it's a fair deck, then that was just good luck that you got dealt two aces. But maybe the card was stacked with aces, and that's a more interesting hypothesis, right? Now, just to summarize with the p-value is not usable for inductive inference because it is a purely negative and non-relative measure. So remember earlier on I said that to do inference, we need some data, but we also need a reasoning process, and we should have at least two hypotheses to compare to each other. The p-value only compares itself to the null hypothesis, and it doesn't even do that because it's calculated under the assumption that the null hypothesis is true. So we should not have a purely negative and non-relative measure, and we should have at least two competing hypotheses. And of course, as we said, a large effect in a small trial and a small effect in a large trial might produce the same p-value, which is a problem if effect size is important, which obviously it is. And just one slide on confidence intervals. I'm going to, before I move on, confidence intervals have most of the same problems as p-values. The same logic that I took you through with the p-value is also embedded in the confidence interval. And but the one thing the confidence interval gives you is it does give you a sense of effect size. Which of those definitions do you prefer for a confidence interval? Number two? Number one, anyone? Number two is correct. I forget what I was going to say about this slide. Okay, so minding the cues. I call the cues the questions, the hypothesis test. So, and try to keep Bayes' theorem in your mind as we're going through this. So Neyman and Pearson, another couple of statisticians from the earlier part of the 20th century, they realized that the p-value was lacking as a measure of inference. But they also wished to avoid the subjective part of Bayes' theorem, which is the prior, stating the prior. In the case of a casino game or maybe in a screening test where you have good epidemiologic data about what that prior probability should be, that's one thing. But if you're a scientist trying to evaluate some new treatment, for example, trying to say before you do your data analysis what you think the probability of your hypothesis being true or false is, that's kind of, you're not separate from that. So it's a subjective thing. And so Neyman and Pearson wanted to avoid this, and so they proposed framing a research question in the form of two hypotheses and performing a test using the observed data. And we've all seen this in our introductory stats courses, the hypothesis test. But what we need to remember is that the outcome from a hypothesis test was meant to be a behavior, a decision to do something. It was never meant to be an inference. It was never meant to be a statement of evidence. And Pearson and Neyman were clear about this. Okay, but again, we tend to do this this method where if we test a hypothesis and we find a significant result, we basically suggest there's evidence for something. They were very clear that they did not want that to be the result of their test. Anyway, so what was the behavior? What was the Neyman and Pearson's proposed behavior? It was to reject one hypothesis and accept the other based solely on the observed data. And of course, this introduces two kinds of risks. One is that you reject a null hypothesis when it's true. That's a type 1 error, alpha. Or you don't reject a null hypothesis when it's false, and that's a type 2 error rate. Now, this is also very important. When was the last time anyone saw an alpha different than 0.05 or a two-tailed 0.025? Anybody? When was the last time? It doesn't happen, right? It's always the same. Well, they wanted judgment to be used. And depending on your specific scenario, they wanted judgment to be used in choosing alpha and beta based on, in your context, the seriousness of making each kind of error. And these aren't medical science examples, but they're extreme examples nonetheless. You know, you remember the famous Super Bowl incident. Well, the seriousness of a button coming undone on a shirt is nothing compared to the seriousness of an emergency shutoff rod not going into a nuclear reactor. That's a picture of the ill-fated new isotope reactors in Chalk River that were supposed to supply the world with new supply of medical isotopes. In testing, one of the emergency rods failed to go in to the reactor. I think it was the first try, but I'm not sure about that. And it ended up being quite a big deal because it was designed on paper, this reactor, and then they built it, and then it didn't work, and then they had this thing that they had to try to make work after having already built it. And they're mothballed now because they couldn't make it happen. But obviously, what's the seriousness of not being able to turn off a nuclear reactor when you want to turn it off? That's a different alpha than a shirt button. This is what Neyman and Pearson said. No test based on a theory of probability can by itself provide any valuable evidence of the truth or falsehood of a hypothesis. Without knowing whether a hypothesis is true or false, we may search for rules to govern behavior with regard to them, in following which we ensure that in the long run, we will not often be wrong. Okay, so what did that mean? well, I guess it's pretty clear, but putting another interpretation on it, it's that there's a trade-off. If you want to claim objectivity, if you want to dispense with stating your prior belief, like Bayes' theorem requires you to, if you want to dispense with all that and be someone just observing what happens, then you must give up the ability to infer evidence in a single experiment. Okay? Hypotheses of, it's kind of interesting, they've been likened to a system of justice where the system of justice isn't overly concerned with the guilt or innocence of any specific individual, just as long as wrongful convictions are rare. So what's the advantage of that kind of a system of justice? Well, if you could think of one, well, it's good to control for mistakes and not make too many. But the disadvantage is that you know, you want people who are accused of something to be correctly judged. And so maybe we should try to carry that value through into doing science. Okay? And if we use these long-run properties and which work in the long run, but we, in any specific study, say this means there's evidence here, we're kind of doing this kind of thing where we're, you know, we hope that most times we're getting it right. So what happened? How did this all happen? Well, the hypothesis test and the p-value became joined in a combined method. It's called in the literature, it's called the combined method. So what do you do? Well, the recipe is this. You specify a null and alternative hypothesis. Before the experiment, you set the type 1 error rate, alpha, to 5%, and power to 80 or 90%, which is a type 2 error of 20 or 10. Perform the experiment or the study, calculate the p-value, and then if the p-value is less than alpha, we reject the null hypothesis and conclude there is evidence that, and we've all seen this, there is evidence that, or there was a decrease, or there was an increase. You know, taking these long-run measures and saying this is evidence in this case, that's not strictly speaking correct to do that, but it's ubiquitous. So, you could see the appeal of this method though, this combined method, because it appears to be deductive. It associates the p-value with the null hypothesis. It controls for the chance of error, which is good, and it presents absoluteness by presenting a probability. When you see a probability, there's like, wow, that's the number, right? Another interesting thing about Fisher and Neyman and Pearson, they lived at the same time. They did not get along all that well with each other. Fisher did not like the hypothesis test, and he wasn't shy about expressing his displeasure with it. And so there were some pretty lively discussions at the Royal Statistical Society. But one thing they were unanimous about is that this combined method is wrong, right? Fisher would not have liked using these long-run properties to say you've got evidence right here in this study. Pearson and Neyman would not have liked a standard alpha and beta being used for everything. So they would all have been opposed to this. So we've got this fusion of methods from these different scientists who didn't agree with each other, and the way they're being used, they would be in unanimous agreement that the way they're being used is wrong. So quite a bit of a historical statistical mess, we should call it, I guess. So how did it happen? Well, about all I could find is that if you forget that the alpha needs to be specified before you do your analysis, and if you forget or at least don't notice the difference of that and the p-value, which is calculated after the analysis, and you see these are both very small numbers, which are you often would expect to find them together with each other in a statistical distribution. These two different things, the alpha, you know, something, a rate that you specify before, is getting confused with the number you calculate afterwards. And it allowed researchers to believe that they didn't have to make this trade-off between evidence and objectivity, which Neyman and Pearson were clear about if you use a frequentist test method. So there are different sort of causes if you search the literature. One theme seems to be that academics, governments, and journals all found it useful to have a quantitative method that generated conclusions that were perceived to be independent of the person producing the data. And there was a belief that objectivity produced the most reliable science. But what happened was quantitative skills began to replace medical knowledge, and sometimes to the extent that the numbers were seen to speak for themselves. That's why at the beginning I showed that definition for data. Data is it's a basis for reasoning and analysis. It doesn't speak for itself. If I deal you two aces out of a deck of cards, that doesn't tell you anything about the deck of cards, right? Okay. This is a quote. I love this quote. This is by Anthony Edwards, who is a protege of Ronald Fisher's. Not a fan of the hypothesis test either. He said, what used to be called judgment, this is in the early 70s, what used to be called judgment is now called prejudice. And what used to be called prejudice is now called a null hypothesis. It's dangerous nonsense, and it will cause much trouble before it is widely appreciated as such. So I thought I'd just give us a two-minute stretch break right now. Look at a cartoon, and we'll start again in 2 minutes. Try not to go off and have coffee somewhere and just stick around in the room.
By the way, your feedback on these workshops is really valuable, so we're going to be circulating evaluation forms by email this time, so you can in about an hour or so. And we also have paper copies if you choose to fill it out by hand. But otherwise, in about an hour, you'll have this online survey. Thank you.
Okay, should we get going again? Everyone able to stretch your legs? It was a fear I had of allowing a stretch break that people would start leaving. But, okay, I think most of us are still here. So let's get going again. Let's get back to Bayes' theorem. So, as I said, specifying a prior, this is what makes Bayes' theorem controversial. And I'll just tell you right now that there's no right way to form a prior. There are opinions, different ways. There might even be a majority opinion, and I have a question mark there because I don't know. But there is no right way. And there are many kinds of priors you can put forward. And I won't define all of them, but there's uniform priors where you just assume any hypothesis is equally likely to occur before you look at the data. There are skeptical hypotheses where you're skeptical that the treatment works, so you're going to specify a skeptical prior, which means you're going to want some really strong data to overturn that opinion. There's enthusiastic priors where we're we really think this drug is great, and this is what we think before we look at the data. Empirical, expert opinion, past experience, and the list goes on. One thing that should be common to all priors, though, is that they should concede a reasonable amount of uncertainty. And so if you, and I've seen this, I have some experience collecting priors from physicians. If you are certain that a certain hypothesis is true, so you're 100% sure, or you're 100% sure it's wrong, there's no amount of data that, if you did a study, there's no amount of data that can overcome that. That's a spike. And the best way to think of it is just looking at a Z statistic. We know the sample size is obviously a part of calculating the Z statistic. And when you have a position where a probability is certain, that really is you're equating that to an infinite number of subjects. And so when you think of a prior, you can always usually think of the prior relating to a number of patients or events, right? And if you're certain in your position as your prior before looking at the data, what you're really saying is there's an infinite number of patients that this drug's going to work for, or whatever the example is. And so all priors, regardless of how you come up with them, they should express some amount of uncertainty across different possible hypotheses. So let's work through a CNODS example. And I've chosen a little bit biased and a little bit of a biased way to go through the statins diabetes study. Now, when we did the statin diabetes analysis, we wrote a scientific protocol as our first protocol. And in that protocol, we said that we expected to find a 15% relative increase in diabetes on the high potency versus the low potency statins. And we used the existing literature to form this opinion. And one of the meta-analyses we used, meta-analyses of RCTs, was one by Priest and colleagues. This one was particularly relevant because they included studies of more intensive versus less intensive statins. And that meta-analysis reported an odds ratio of 1.12, and that's the confidence interval. And then our CNOT study this year reported an odds ratio close to 1.12, 1.15, and that was our confidence interval. But now what we did is we used the standard methods. We did our analysis, and the way we addressed things like the pre-med analysis, which you could use as a basis for a prior if we wanted to do a Bayesian analysis, it wouldn't be crazy to assume before we did our study that what Priest and colleagues found was that's a reasonable prior, I think. Maybe you would disagree. That's, again, part of the controversy of a prior, but I think it's not unreasonable to do this. Okay? But what we ended up doing is we, instead of doing a Bayesian analysis, we try to address these things using written English in our manuscripts, right? So in the introduction, we talked about why we expected to find 1.15 and what previous work had found. And then in the discussion section, we said this is really compatible with what previous people found, and so everything is wonderful. But we didn't go through the formal step of combining these two sources of data formally, which is what Bayes' theorem can do.
Maybe I'm stepping
ahead,
but would it be reasonable to use the confidence interval as your error around your prior?
Yes, and that's what we'll do. So as I said, the CNOT study was partly motivated by the Priest meta-analysis. And I just talked about this, how we basically use a written argument instead of formally using Bayes' theorem when we talk about past studies. But now what if we had used Bayes' theorem to combine these two sources of data? Well, this we'll have to spend a little bit of time on this slide, but this is essentially a Bayesian analysis of the CNOT study using the Priest meta-analysis as the prior. So, So let's start with this graph at the top. This is the prior distribution, and we've used the Priest study, and as Pierre suggested, it's got maximum value at an odds ratio of 1.2. Plotted here is the natural logarithm of the odds ratio, and that's because the distribution of the odds ratio it would be skewed. It can't go below zero, and it can go up to infinity on the other side. But the natural logarithm of the odds ratio, it's reasonable to assume in this case that a normal distribution would be suitable. And so we have the result, and we put a normal distribution around it, and the top of the distribution corresponds to the maximum likelihood estimate, and then the dispersion of the distribution corresponds to the 95% confidence interval, which we just reverse engineered into the standard deviation. And when you do this, you can get a distribution like this, and we can, for any possible value of hypothesis, any possible logs-odds ratio, we can compute this probability of theta, and that gives us our function there. This is a statistical distribution. If we sum it across all possible values of log-odds ratios, it sums to 1. Okay, so that's our prior probability distribution. And then we treat the data part as the CNODE statin study. Okay, we found an odds ratio of 1.15, and there's the confidence interval. Now, this is not a statistical distribution here. Okay, this is a likelihood function, and we'll talk more about likelihoods later. But for now, what you should know about likelihoods is we can compute it as there, assuming a normal likelihood. But there's no requirement for a likelihood function to sum to 1 across all possible values of the hypothesis. It can sum to less than 1, it can sum to greater than 1. And that's not a problem, and we'll see why later. But so we can take our CNODES data and create this likelihood function. And then we can do something which is called a conjugate normal analysis. And what that says is that if you have a prior distribution which is normally distributed, and if you have a likelihood function from your data which is normally follows a normal, or behaves according to a normal likelihood, you can multiply them together at each value of hypothesis. So you would take the value at, say, 0.04 log odds ratio times the value of the likelihood at 0.04 odds ratio. And then you get a posterior distribution, which is a statistical distribution again. It's assumed to be normally distributed. Every possible hypothesis sums together, integrated across all the possible values of log odds ratio sums to 1. And we have now formally combined the prior data from the Priest meta-analysis with the CNODE statin study to produce this posterior distribution, which is a hybrid of both the studies put together. Okay? And what I've done here is I've just used the meta-analytic result from the CNODE study. We could have actually carried this through, and we could have taken the prior and multiplied it by the likelihood function for Alberta, multiplied with Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and so forth. So if we had another meta-analysis of statins and diabetes, we could then add it again as well. Okay, but I just used the total meta-analytic result, and we have this result here. And just blowing up that bottom graph, just make it a little bit bigger. When we've now formally combined the Priest meta-analysis with the CNODE study, we have a combined odds ratio of 1.13. And then Bayesians, instead of calling it a 95% confidence interval, they call it a credible interval to distinguish it from its frequentist counterpart. And the 95% credible interval is just the bounds that fence in 95% of the probability, right? And so the 95% credible interval is 1.06 to 1.20. It's pretty straightforward to think of credible intervals when you have a normal distribution. Sometimes the posterior distribution follows is not normal, and there are different versions of doing these credible intervals, but this is the most simple one.
Colin, why 95%? If you're moving away from frequentist notions, why are you grounded in
it's Bayesians do it too. Yeah, it's I don't know. Yeah. But it's a credible interval, and it's not a confidence interval.
Thanks for that clarification.
But I got good stuff coming, David, so on that point.
No, this is good. You said you could have done each center. Would that have been better for some reason than just combining the two meta-analyses?
It wouldn't have made any difference. Because the likelihoods of all individual centers combined are the CNODE's likelihood. It was easier to do it this way, and I think more intuitive. Okay, well, so what is a probability anyway? I think most of us, when we think of a probability, think of the frequentist probability, which is the occurrence of an event after many repetitions, such as drawing a card from a well-shuffled deck. And in fact, all of our rules of probability, at least the core rules, the addition rule, multiplication, those are based on this frequentist definition. And Bayes' theorem is based on this frequentist definition. But the key to the frequentist probability is this concept of choice from a defined population. Now, as I said, Bayes' theorem is derived from a frequentist definition of probability, but Bayesian analysis, the probability is meant to express a degree of belief. Okay, it's not a frequentist probability. So Bayes' theorem, based on frequentist probability, Bayesian analysis, it's based on what's known as a subjective probability. Okay, and let's think about this. So if our study was a Bayesian analysis related to card playing, our prior of getting a card would look something like that. It would be a uniform prior. Each card has the same chance of getting drawn, just under 0.02. Okay. That's something I think we can really get our heads around as being something that comes from a defined population where something is being drawn at random from that population. Okay. It gets a little bit murkier when we talk about medical screening tests. We have, in many cases, good epidemiologic data to suggest how many people out in the population have a disease at any point in time. But it's a little bit more abstract. The population is a little bit harder to define in our minds than a deck of cards. And we do know that we don't always catch these things, and maybe there's some uncertainty in that estimate, okay? And then what about using a prior that's just based on expert opinion, where we, for example, go to Pierre and say, Pierre, there's this new inhaler. What do you think? What do you think? Before we look at this data, what are your expectations? That's not a defined population. No random choice argument involved there. This is just a subjective probability, okay? So clearly, we use Bayes' theorem for all of these things, but there's a real difference here between what a probability means, okay? So what if we used, instead of the pre-SMET analysis, what if we just went to a group of experts, maybe some experts in diabetes and cardiovascular medicine or whatnot, internal medicine, clinical pharmacologists, you name it, and as a group, we got them to specify what their prior was, okay? And say they said, well, statins are good drugs. We think on balance, because of what they do for cardiovascular risk and knowing that diabetes and cardiovascular disease or whatever they're thinking is, they think that there's a 10% protective effect of a higher potency statin compared to a lower potency statin, and they're 99% sure that it's not going to increase diabetes. Well, you can translate that into an odds ratio and a confidence interval, and you can form a prior distribution with it. So say we did that. So say instead of using the pre-SMET analysis, we used expert opinion. And then we worked it through with our CNODES data, and I've just had to shift things a bit here to get them all to fit, okay? And we can do the same analysis as before, and we can come up with our posterior distribution. But instead, as before, where I think it was at 1.13 was the combined result with pre and CNODES, it's now an odds ratio of 0.99. And there's the credible interval around that. But let me ask you, whose probability distribution is this? Is it yours? Is it mine? Is it even the experts who are so sure that there would be no increase observed in the data? It's a very subjective measure. And I'll talk about this in a little bit better, but this idea of subjective probability is at the very least, well, for some people at the very least problematic. Here's an interesting fellow you might never have heard of, Frank Ramsey. He was a philosopher of mathematics, which I just assume is a mathematician now. but he was best known for his subjective theory of probability. So he said that this is okay. Like, it's okay to express the intensity of your belief in something as a number between 0 and 1. He said it's okay. And this became the basis for Bayesian analysis and subjective probability. And he later wrote that we should choose a system which gives the highest chance to the facts observed. And he noted that this was Fisher's principle of maximum likelihood, which we'll get to. And regrettably, he died very young, and he wasn't able to reconcile these statements. The Bayesians point to this all the time, his subjective theory of probability, but you never hear them talk about his kind of second thoughts about it. Okay. So, food for thought. If your statistical model is framed entirely of probabilities, another way of putting that is if you don't have a defined population that behaves according to known characteristics, then the posterior distribution will only be an aggregate, a phenomenon that defies exact analysis. And in that context, asserting that probability for the truth of a hypothesis is, well, if you're a devout Bayesian, you would say it's fine. Subjective probability is fine. We're just taking our intensity of belief and putting that on a scale between 0 and 1. But if you're someone like Fisher or Edwards or a likelihood person, you would say it's completely vacuous. Like, what does that number really mean? And are people just going to misinterpret that?
That's what a prior is, though.
Yeah. But the posterior, but the posterior has the prior in it. And but what it doesn't mean, what I think we can all agree, and even Bayesians, is what it doesn't mean is this is not a frequentist number. It's not anything like that. It's a degree of belief, an intensity of belief expressed as a number on the interval 0, 1. Okay. Okay, now this is the exciting part. What can recovering frequentists and Bayesians do? So as a formula derived from the widely accepted rules of probability, Bayes' theorem isn't controversial, but its application in medical science is because of this, stating this prior. In medical science, it's the white lab coat science, objectivity, rigor, and this idea of stating an opinion that just makes you seem biased before doing your study. So it's really, it's really not penetrated medical science to a large degree. There certainly are Bayesian studies done, but this was always a problem. But, and this is opinion here, of course, the important thing is how we use the data to make decisions, right? And so maybe getting that final probability number isn't as important as some people think it is, okay? But how can we bring these two worlds together, the frequentist world and the Bayesian world? Well, looking back at Bayes' theorem, you can actually specify a version of Bayes' theorem called the odds form of Bayes' theorem. And the odds form of Bayes' theorem is that, assuming you have the same data, you have two competing hypotheses, you can take the ratio of those two equations and you can get the odds form of Bayes' theorem. On the right-hand side there, you have the ratio of your priors. And in the middle here, you have something called the likelihood ratio. Okay, and I'm going to talk to you about how we might be able to use this likelihood ratio to get what we need. And maybe we can ignore that part and that part going forward. Okay, so first the likelihood principle. The likelihood, I just make sure I didn't skip a slide there. Okay. The likelihood principle states that all the information that the data provide about a parameter is contained in the likelihood function. And we don't need to dwell on this, but it just it helps remove paradoxes from what you're doing. The strongest argument against using p-values in confidence intervals is that they violate the likelihood principle. Bayes' theorem does not. Bayes' theorem is compatible with the likelihood principle, which makes sense because it's in the theorem, right? Okay, so let's spend a little bit of time on this slide. So let's define likelihood. The likelihood, usually specified as a capital L, is of a hypothesis theta given the data y and a specific model. We always do things in the context of a specific model. So we assume some model, some way the data are supposedly behaving. Is proportional to the probability of the data given the hypothesis, the constant of proportionality being arbitrary. Don't worry about that arbitrary part. But let's consider this example to help us understand likelihoods. Consider a binomial model for the treatment assignment of two patients, so a small experiment, two patients, to an RCT, so a two-patient RCT. And let Y1 be the data set where zero get assigned to the treatment. Let Y1 be the data set that would happen if one got assigned to each arm. And let Y3 be the data set where both patients got assigned to the treatment. And we'll let P be the probability of being assigned to the treatment. So right here, I have our possible data sets as the columns here, the inner columns. And then I've specified three values of theta, 0.25, 0.5, and 0.75. Going across the row here, this is the case where, well, first of all, let me say this. So if we've done an experiment, one of these things is going to happen. We're going to, after we do our trial of two people, we'll have a data set which is Y1, Y2, or Y3. We won't have all of them if we've just done this trial once. One of these data sets will happen. But if they all happened, the way it's defined with these two patients, these are exhaustive and mutually exclusive. And so all of the probabilities in the row will add to one. Okay? And that happens in each case. But if we've just done this trial once, which is usually how we do a trial, we do it once, in medicine anyway, we're going to pick, one of these will happen. And so say it's Y1. Well, this is different. The probability is the same. The probability of theta equals 0.25 and Y1, this is 5.5625. These two numbers don't happen. This data set has happened. And what this is saying is, given if we're assuming that theta is 0.25, P is 0.25, well, 0.5625 is the, we'll just call it weight for now, that we would assign to this hypothesis. But remember, zero were treated here, and zero of the patients were treated, and so you would expect that a probability of treatment closer to zero, which 0.25 is compared to the others, would have more probability weight with it than with these other ones. Okay? And what we can do is do something called a likelihood ratio. So now we're comparing hypotheses. We want to know which hypotheses are most compatible with the data. And so given that we've observed Y1, we didn't observe those other ones. Given the data we've observed, we can compare the probability with each of these hypotheses, and we can calculate something called the likelihood ratio. And so if we've observed a data set of two patients where zero were assigned to treatment, and we want to know what's the underlying probability of being assigned to treatment, well, we know that 0.25 intuitively is closer to zero patients getting treated than a 50-50 chance or a 0.75 chance. And so what does that mean? It means that the likelihood of P being 0.25 versus 0.5 is 2.25 times higher. That's the idea behind a likelihood ratio. Okay? A little bit more math here, but try to hang with me. Let's think of a bit more of an involved example. There was a trial, last year, called the Crystal trial, where they compared giving two types of colloids and crystalloids to patients suffering from hypervolemic shock. And they looked at mortality after these treatments. 90-day mortality was one of their outcomes. So we can imagine a situation like this, where what happens to any single patient is the consequence of a Bernoulli trial, right? And in the Crystal example, there were 1,414 patients who were given colloids for fluid resuscitation, and that was the main treatment they were interested in. Crystalloids were the control exposure. And if we assume what happens to each patient in terms of survival is a Bernoulli, basically a Bernoulli trial, we can fit that information into a binomial likelihood. And if we do that, let's look at the example of two patients. So we're thinking of things on the level of an individual patient. So the green line would be an example of a patient who was alive 28 days. That might have to be 90 days. I might have made a mistake at 28 days. I think they did both in the trial, but I think the data I used were for 90 days. Well, if we assume a binomial likelihood, then for each possible value of the true probability of death, we can calculate this likelihood, right, by feeding it in for any individual patient. So if we think that theta is 0.1, 10%, we can calculate a likelihood value to be minus 0.105. And we can do this for this patient. We can do that same calculation for different assumptions about p going across from 0 to 1. Okay, and we can do the same thing for patients who died. We can calculate the log likelihood. I guess I've done the log likelihood here because it's easier to for addition purposes. Okay, where they cross is at 0.5, which is what you're saying is you're equally likely to die or not die, and so there's really no difference between those curves at that point. Okay. Now, what we can do, we have 1,414 patients who got the colloids, which means we have, and then I think it was 434 who did not survive, and so we have 434 of these red lines, and we have the remainder as these green lines, and so for each value of theta, we can take 434 log likelihoods and add them together with the remainder, 1414 minus 434 for the survivors. And when we can pool them together, we can get this combined log likelihood function, which isn't terribly interpretable on its own. One thing we can do with it, before doing something more important with it, is remember a few slides back, I told you that the likelihood function is defined up to an arbitrary constant. Well, what that means is we can scale that whole function to an arbitrary constant, and you can scale it to zero. So I've just taken that and I've made zero, where the likelihood is zero, as making everything relative to that. But if we, it's a log likelihood, if we anti-log this thing, we can get a likelihood ratio function. And what that shows us is that, and it's a bit hard to see on this scale, but what this shows us is the probability of survival in patients given colloids, relative probability of survival in patients given colloids across all these possible probabilities of survival. And what you can't see over here is that this has been made reference to 0.35 has been made the reference here. And so if we go up here to, what is that, about 0.305, something like that, that says that in the patients given the colloids, that the probability of survival was 300, a little over 350 times more likely in the data than 0.35. Okay, and you can do that for all these hypotheses. So if you think that going into the analysis 0.35 was the probability of survival, and then you observe your data, you can see how relatively likely all of those possible survival probabilities are compared to what you expected at 0.35. However, it was a randomized trial, and there was a control arm. We can't just assume that 35% was the right number, and that we're perfectly accurate about that. You could take what happened in the control group, and you can form a similar distribution. And then you would need to compare these somehow, because we don't have that reference value of 0.35. That's not certain. But what you can do is you can... you could take the, say, the risk difference, the absolute risk increase or risk reduction, and you can form a similar function. And now we have, and so what it was something like 3.5%, I think, in the crystal trial between the colloid patients and the crystalloid patients, there was a 3.5% risk difference, 90-day risk difference. And now our maximum likelihood estimate is only 7 times more likely then no effect. And the reason for that, the reason we've gone from 350 times is because we're including the uncertainty that around that 35% that was seen in the control group. But this gives us a way of weighing alternative hypotheses against each other. So if our default is that there's no difference between colloids and crystalloids going into the trial, we can observe our data, we can plot this a function like this, and we can compare all the possibilities to each other, or to do a reference, or just say no difference. And so what was observed in the trial was 7 times more likely to have occurred given the data. Let me rephrase. A risk reduction of 3.5% was 7 times more likely than no difference in the data in that trial. That's a more accurate way of putting it. Okay. So I haven't given you a probability like Bayes' theorem would, right? But I've given you relative evidence. Okay. And so in this slide, I've compared the risk difference to no effect. This one divided by this, which is 7, to make it more comparable to how we think of things in terms of alpha and p-values, you can just flip that ratio and you could divide 0 by the minus 3.5% likelihood. So just reversing it, 1 over 7, and you get 0.14. And so what do we do with this? So we haven't done a full Bayesian analysis. We don't have a full inductive inference, but we can still phrase our results in a certain way to at least acknowledge Bayes' theorem and inductive inference. And so I've got here 3 ways of making a probability statement or an evidence statement. So one's here is called the objective statement. So with these data from the crystal trial, we could say the observed results are 14% as probable under the null hypothesis as they are under the alternative hypothesis. Okay. We haven't used any long-run properties here. P-values, alpha, beta, that doesn't enter into it. We're only using the observed data to make this statement. So we've eliminated this long-run thinking, okay? Another way of doing it is called the inductive evidence statement, which is the evidence supports the null hypothesis one-seventh as strongly as the alternative hypothesis. And then there's something you could phrase it as kind of a subjective probability statement. The odds of the null hypothesis relative to the alternative hypothesis after the trial are 1/7 what they were before the trial. And this is kind of a bow to Bayesian analysis and Bayes' theorem. Taking a likelihood ratio and phrasing it this way, you're at least acknowledging that you haven't produced a posterior probability and you haven't done a full inductive inference, right? This example, one of the reasons I chose it, I was looking around for a trial where the p-value was kind of close to 0.05. And one of the reasons I did that is, you remember when we talked about the p-value, we said that it was the probability of your result or a result more extreme than what you observed given the null is true. That having data in the p-value that you haven't actually observed causes you to overstate the evidence against the null, the evidence against the null. And so what we have when we look at likelihood ratios, comparing the maximum likelihood estimate to no effect in the crystal trial, we get a number of 0.14. The crystal investigators reported a p-value of 0.03. And so this crystal trial, I think I've misspelled crystal there, I think it's with an A, it shows how a p-value can overstate the evidence against the null. This is more important for p-values kind of close to 0.05. If you get really small p-values, it becomes trivial. But for p-values that are just crossing 0.05 into significance, the effect of unobserved data is really playing a large role there. And so how could we do this in a CNODES analysis? So we looked at a Bayesian analysis of the statins diabetes, CNODES statin diabetes study. But we produced this posterior probability. And if you really want to think that's a probability for the truth of those hypotheses on that distribution, you can. But what you can also do is you can just do what's called a likelihood ratio meta-analysis. And what I've done here is I've basically formed the likelihood ratio functions for all of the individual sites in the CNODE statins AKI study. And I've done an example here where we use the Jupiter trial as kind of our prior. But this is not, we're not starting with a probability distribution as our prior. We've just taken the Jupiter study and we've put it into a likelihood ratio function along with the rest of them. And likelihood ratios can be multiplied together at the same value of theta or the same hypothesis, and a natural logarithm of the likelihood ratio can be added together. And what we do is we can take these likelihood ratio functions, and what we'll do is we take the natural logarithm, and then for each possible value of log odds ratio, we sum them together, and then if at the end we anti-log them again, we can get the combined meta-analytic effect. And this is expressed now as, it looks very similar to a forest plot, but instead of having 95% confidence intervals, I now have something called a 95% intrinsic confidence interval, because it's not a confidence interval and it's not a credible interval, but it's something that's more akin to of the bounds where once you go outside these bounds, those odds ratios are less than 1/20th as likely as what was observed, which kind of corresponds roughly to a 5% error rate. Okay, just a quick summary slide here. So we study drugs for knowledge, that's true, but we also do it to assist with decisions. And if for you ultimate knowledge is getting that probability, then I guess you need to do a Bayesian analysis. You need to ask, you should ask yourself what that probability means, though. Is that your probability, someone else's probability? Is it the probability? Okay, but we're also doing this to help regulators and clinicians make decisions about what drugs to use. And so maybe ask yourself, is that really, do we really need to get the final probability to do that? Or do we need ways of just weighing the possibilities against each other? If you're fine with that, likelihood ratios do that for you. They allow you to quantitatively compare the different possibilities, okay? But we don't get the final inductive inference with a likelihood ratio. We just get relative evidence. And you do get the final inductive answer with Bayes' theorem, but is it the answer that means anything to you? So that's what I had to say today, I think, about likelihood ratios and Bayes' theorem. But I'll just ask you now, which camp are you in? Are you a frequentist? So are you someone who believes in frequentist probability and methods for evidence? Are you a Bayesian, subjective probability? Are you a likelihoodist? Are you a Ramsian, which means you're still thinking on it? Or are you other, but you're sure? And I had to say but sure because I think this one kind of covers it. Pierre.
I have some experience with likelihood ratios clinically, using diagnostic tests. And they make perfect sense in that way, because you'd be in front of a patient, you have some idea, you have a hypothesis. I think this patient has asthma. I do a test, spirometry, and it shows airflow obstruction. Well, I'm now much more likely that he has asthma, given what my prior probability is. So I have no trouble with that reasoning, but I found a little strange there. You give a likelihood ratio of 7. Well, clinically, in diagnostic test, I think a likelihood ratio of 7 is pretty good. But you're telling me that's equivalent to a p-value of 0.14. So there, now you're telling me two different things. That's something that I would take as, oh, that's useful. You're telling me it's not based on the p-value you found.
So this is, it's true. Actually, I think one thing that I have a little trouble with is that the reported, I don't get that same p-value when I calculate the p-value with the crystal data. I get a p-value closer to 0.05. So, likelihood ratio of 7 is about equivalent to a p-value of about 0.05. This is something that's a matter of what would you say, preference. Pito has written that in the case of a meta-analysis, you really want a likelihood ratio of something like 150 or 100. I can't remember exactly. Like, you want a pretty high likelihood ratio before you conclude something's a real effect.
The diagnostic test, they say 10. They say 10 and above, yes. 5 to 10, could be helpful. I find a 7.
Yeah, 7's not very strong. But it's context dependent. For a benefit, 7's maybe not very strong because you're going to expose a lot of patients to this drug. But if you're thinking of investigating a harm, 7's not that bad. 2, 3, 4 is maybe this is worth taking a closer look at.
Yeah, very nice talk. It will take me a while to just hold it. Very nice talk. You mentioned the fact that the big problem is the a priori probability. And if you take that into the field of diagnosis, it's not too bad because it's a prevalence of the disease in the population from which the patient comes. You frequently have data on that. But you go to what we do, which is pharmacoepidemiology, and then your priori is a priori is 5 cases of patients who died while they were on domperidone. How do you transform that into a priori probability? It's impossible.
Yeah, well, it's subjective as what it is. It's somewhat data driven. I guess you're using those patients to form your opinion.
In this case, you gave the example of the Jupiter trial, okay? Which diabetes was not the main outcome, but they got some reason on the data. But most of the time, we work on spontaneous event notifications that reach a level at which Health Canada starts worrying. How do you do a priori about that?
I don't know. One of the possibilities is how do you get the right? How do you get the prior? What if, for example, it's expert opinion, and what if that opinion is enthusiastic about the drug, or what if it's overly skeptical, and then you have the data. Well, if the data maybe aren't so flattering to the drug, but the prior was, you could end up with a conclusion, which is the drug is great. And on the other side of the coin, if the regulator was overly skeptical about the drug and the data were a bit better, you could still end up with So the prior is very important, and I see enormous potential for it to lead to kind of crazy decisions.
The prior feel that whether the regulator thinks it's a signal or it's not. If he thinks it's a signal, then the prior gets higher, and then they start considering that the study maybe should be done. So the threshold to do the study is already some sort of a prior. Okay. The question is, how do you put a number on that prior? I think it's impossible. Because, the spontaneous event reporting, we all know that it's extremely weak, the denominators are all sorts of problems.
I think you'd find people who would try, though, to come up with.
Would try, despite the
expert opinion or past experience, they would try to.
I think that's one of the reasons why formal Bayesian thinking has not penetrated clinical medicine, is that in a way it goes into the mantra of evidence-based medicine, which is that expert opinion is no good.
Yeah.
So then you're stuck with this problem that you start with expert opinion when in fact you're saying expert opinion is not good because it's almost always wrong. So the priority becomes extremely difficult. It's not impossible for the side effects of the drug or even for the beneficial effects of the drug. It can be extremely useful in diagnostic tests because there your a priori is the presence of the disease or the incidence or the prevalence of the disease in the population. And we often have data for that. So then we can work from that, and that's your priority. But in efficacy or safety of drugs, I find it very difficult with Cambridge.
I agree. But for Pierre's example, you had to make a decision, like, am I going to do something to this patient or not? And the likelihood ratio is useful there. You know how much more likely something is.
How much more likely a diagnosis is that I'm going to treat a patient.
Yeah.
One way versus another. It might be the diagnosis of asthma versus COPD, which are two different treatments. So I need to use it for probability of diagnosis, not for probability of response to therapy. Well, it is. that too is a diagnosis predicts whether response to therapy. There was Adrian first, and then Chris, and then Sandy.
Thank you. So, Colin, thank you. That's great. Very interesting, illuminating. This is like evidence-informed decision-making when faced with a surgeon and needing something. And the surgeon says, do you want this? And I say, I don't know. You tell me whether I want it. So you ask, what is your school of thought? I don't know, Colin. What you tell me what to believe here.
I think I'm a likelihoodist. You know, the situation Pierre described with his patient is something we can do with the type of work we do, which is we don't say the probability is this that our estimate's right, but we say this is X times more likely than this. And then you still need a construct for making the decisions. How many times more does something need to be likely than the alternative? You still need some kind of index or a reference value to make a decision. But it seems to me that we don't need a probability at the end of it. We also don't want to assume these frequentist long-run properties either. Unobserved data. To me, the likelihood ratio is very eloquent and can give us what we need.
It sounds to me like it all requires judgment.
Well, everything does at the end. Like the likelihood ratio, someone still has to put a decision on that. It's big enough or it's not.
Chris, so I guess I'm going to say a bit of a contrarian question, but are we all, I guess intuitively, do we all want to be, are we all closet Bayesians? In that I agree that there's a huge problem in trying to quantify the prior distribution, but when we're particularly in medicine, what we really want to know is p-values are often misinterpreted as the probability of the hypothesis given the data. Confidence intervals are often misinterpreted as if they're credible intervals. Everyone seems to want to be a Bayesian. The problem is the implementation of this Bayesian thought process. Is a way around it just going to uninformative priors all the time? I don't know. It seems.
You mean a uniform prior all the time?
Let the data speak for itself. But when you do that, the results are essentially identical to frequentist methods, except that from a theoretical interpretation, then you can say, okay, the credible interval is, we're 95% certain the truth is in there. And you can get the probability statement is one that you're more interested in. I don't know. I'm thinking about the likelihood. I might convert because I think it's a nice. It seems like a nice way of overcoming some of these issues. I think the other problem is wind bugs beeps at me if I've ever every time I've touched it. So in terms of implementing Bayesian techniques, it's also challenging too. But it's in terms of what we want to get out of it. I think it's often what we're interested in. There's a theoretical. We like what the Bayesian results produce. We just don't. Getting there is quite complicated. I think in medicine we often have a prior belief anyway. We just don't acknowledge it.
Sammy.
So thank you very much, Colin. This was very thought provoking, and clearly you put in a lot of effort in here. So just some distinctions. I think that in terms of the Bayesian priors, my belief is that beliefs come from data. Whether it is conscious or subconscious or so, beliefs come from some kind of data. Whether the data are biased or not is another issue. But there are two places where this can be used. One is, as Jacques was saying, the prior data can be a hypothesis that is being brought. The current data are saying that perhaps there is a problem here, so let's do a study to test this hypothesis. So it becomes, in fact, the hypothesis that you're testing. And to do that, one of the contrary aspects of science is to actually mix data that are generated to create your hypothesis and data used to test that hypothesis. So this is already one principle that would be violated by doing that. The second approach, I think, where this could be very useful is in meta-type analysis. So we have this accumulation of data up to this point. We'd like to add another study, and now we'd like to know what we have up to this point. So presented in that context, I think that the Bayesian approach can be very well, but always data-based. I don't have this, I cannot be convinced of beliefs. I cannot be convinced that Pierre can say, yes, I think the prior probability lies between this and this, and it's normally shaped, or it's U-shaped, or so. So in essence, I think we have to make a distinction between where the priors come. So this is one. Second point is something that you did not mention, and I'm asking you a question, is whether in a p-value, if we increase the study size, that same study will give us a p-value of 0.003, for example, or 0.0003, simply by increasing the sample size and having the same point estimate. Does this affect the likelihood ratio? The likelihood ratio will still remain 7. So somehow we need to know the problems that were occurring with the p-value, are they also occurring with the likelihood ratio?
No.
I know the answer. My final comment is, just like we use different pieces of information to arrive at a conclusion. So we use the p-value, we use the confidence interval, we use sensitivity analysis. I think the likelihood ratio is a nice additional tool to have in this package, in this box that we bring to the table, to talk about what the data are saying and how they can be interpreted in different ways. So these were all my comments and questions.
Do you want to answer all of those?
No, you've answered.